terrific to be here, and I love talking about Martin Luther. It's true that one day I hope we will have a beer with Luther in heaven, and the reason for beer, as you'll see, is because beer was a fairly... it was a part of his life and the way in which he thought and the way in which he engaged with the world around him. And so that's one of the lessons that we're going to learn from him. But to begin with, just looking at the PowerPoint, that picture has been chosen quite deliberately. It's a photograph of a lot of churches in Europe that were built in the Middle Ages. So for that period, think, say, from 1050 through to 1450, that sort of period of time. A lot of churches, big stone, tourist attraction type churches now, were built during that time. When you go to them, there are these big doorways, and above the doorway they have things like that picture, carved out of stone, images that when you're just a simple person arriving for church, the first thing you see is that image. And particularly, remember, we're dealing with people who are largely operating within an illiterate society. And so they don't have their Bibles to read. They don't have access to reading the written word. And so a lot of the information that they receive, the teaching that they receive about the Christian faith, comes from the images that they see. So you turn up for church and that is the image that you see. Now notice, this is only a part of it. The bigger picture is actually Jesus sitting on a throne, and he's got his hands out like this. It's a very common image. On one side, you've got people, a trail of people heading off, and they're all heading off to heaven. And so there are happy-looking angels with bugles blowing in their ears, and they've got sort of smiles on their faces, and they're all marching off in a happy little line to heaven. On his other side, Jesus, because it's Jesus as the judge, on the other side, there's a group of people, and you can just see them on the right hand, your right-hand side as you're looking at the image. You can see them crowding together, and around the ones, those three figures on the right, there's a chain, and they're actually chained together. They're a part of a long conga line of people chained together, and they are all shuffling off to hell. And you'll notice that standing next to them, they're being pushed along by one demon, and next to them is another demon, and you notice that the angel of God has a set of scales, and the angel is weighing in those set of scales. I'm not sure if you can see or not, but there are people, and they're being weighed in the scales of God's justice and being found wanting. And so there's the devil or the demon about to claim them and take them off to hell. Now, that's the first image that you get when you arrive at church every Sunday morning. That God in Christ will judge you by what you have done. You will be weighed in the balance, and if you're found wanting, then demons will usher you off to a terrible time of anguish and gnashing of teeth and eternal hell. But if you are obedient enough, then you will be ushered off with bugles blowing in your ear off to heaven. That's the image, and that's the message of the medieval church. I'm painting general pictures, but that is the dominant message that people were receiving in the medieval church. And it is out of that that Martin Luther, who I'm talking about this evening, it is out of that context that Martin Luther reacts. Because Martin Luther, born into that, wrestles, as we'll see, with the whole question of how can I be right with God? Because as far as he could see, whatever he did, when weighed in the balance, he would be found wanting. Because he had a very profound understanding of what the Bible calls sin, and he recognized the truth of the Bible, which says that all have sinned. There is no one who is righteous, not even one. All have fallen short, and all of us, therefore, are under the judgment of God. And without Christ as a saviour, but rather simply Christ as judge, for Luther, there is this terrible anguish of the soul. As we will see, how can I possibly be right enough and do well enough to be right with God? And it's out of that struggle, as he wrestles with it, that he eventually understands the teaching of the Bible, that we are saved simply by the work of Christ on the cross. And that discovery for Luther, and he goes back and reads some of the church fathers like Augustine, and he finds it all there, set in train a revolution that revolutionized the church, but it actually revolutionized the world. Revolutionized economics, society, politics, as well as the church. And that's what we're looking at, is the man who under God was used to bring about this dramatic reformation, and which we, of course, are all the descendants from, that we are Protestants. We have protested against something. That is to say, we are a part of this reformation of Martin Luther. So that's just why the picture is there, and that's what we're going to be looking at this evening. I should say, as we go along, if you've got any questions, just stick your hand up. I'm very happy. If you don't, I will just keep talking for an hour and I won't stop. So I'm happy with that. But feel very, even if you just think you need a break, put your hand up and that'll at least stop me. So first of all, I just want to ask the question, what was the Reformation? A date, first of all. Everyone thinks church history is full of dates. It's there are some dates that are important. Most of them you don't have to worry too much about. But 1517 is a great date. October 31, it's the beginning in many ways of the Reformation, and we'll see later why. It was really one man's struggle to be right with God in the early 16th century, but it had ramifications, consequences, for us right down to our current day. It was a revolution in theological thinking and practice, and it was also in many ways grace and the Bible on the one hand and works and tradition on the other. And that, in stark contrast, in very broad brush terms, is a description of the conflict that made up the Continental Reformation. And the man at its very heart, that's a sculpture of him, was Martin Luther. So I want to talk a little bit about his early life. He was born in 1482 or 1483 or 1484. He always insisted he was born in 1484, which would, of course, have made him younger. Most books that you read will probably say that he was born in 1483 or even 1482. His mother couldn't remember what year he was born in. His father was a man called Hans Luder. And Hans was a copper miner who had made good. So he'd started off very much as a peasant, but he had done well for himself, he'd made money, and by the time Luther's born and about to go to school, his father is relatively well off. He's not sort of a part of the aristocracy, but he's got enough money to think, in Martin we might have someone who can really make something of himself. Let's send him off to be trained as a lawyer. And so they send him to school, and then they pay for him to go to university, because in those days, to have a lawyer in the family was regarded as prestigious. And it was also regarded as being financially very helpful to have someone like that. And so he goes off to school, he does well, he goes to university, he does well. And it's while he's a university student studying law, he's already got a master's degree in arts and he's wanting to become a lawyer, he's walking back to university in 1505. And it's while he's there in 1505 that something momentous happens. He's almost back at the university in Erfurt. And as he's walking there, he's about 4 miles out and he's caught in a thunderstorm. It's a terrific thunderstorm and a bolt of lightning strikes the ground very close to him. It's so close that he actually is thrown to the ground by it. And in his terror, he cries out, "Help me, St. Anne, I'll become a monk." Now, it was a very middle-aged thing to do. Not middle-aged as in I'm middle-aged, but medieval thing to do. It was the sort of thing that you would expect people. It's calling out not for God, but for a saint. St. Anne was meant to be the mother of Mary, the mother of Jesus. So Jesus' granny is who St. Anne was meant to be. Luther said that he went looking for her in the Bible. This is in later life. He said, "I can't find a word about her. I think God left this unmentioned so that we wouldn't be seeking out new holy places and running to and fro, losing sight of Jesus." But at this stage, he doesn't understand that, so he calls out to St. Anne. It's a patron saint of travellers and various and copper miners. And he engages in a bargain. "You save me and I'll become a monk. So you save me and I'll do something that's going to seem really religious." It's a bargain with God. And so that's what he does. He survives the storm, but obviously it was more than just a rash cry. in the middle of a storm, because those are the sorts of things that we often forget and explain away. But 2 weeks after the storm, Luther presents himself at a monastery in Erfurt, knocks on the door and says, "I want to become a monk." So it was something which obviously had been a thing he'd been thinking about anyway. The storm in some ways had simply hurried him along. And so he approaches a group of Augustinian monks and he asks to be admitted. His father is horrified. His dad's invested a lot of money in Luther's education, and the last thing that he wants is for Luther to be heading off into a monastery and the church to watch all that money he's invested going down the drain, and to find, in fact, that he loses his son, because he loses the likelihood of his son giving him grandchildren and all of those sorts of family things as well. Luther said afterwards, "I became a monk by driving my head through the wall." So in other words, it wasn't easy, but I put my head down and I ran and I drove my head straight through the wall. "I did it against the will of my father. I did it against the will of my mother. I did it against the will of God, and I did it against the will of the devil." In other words, nobody wanted him to do it, but he said, "I did it anyway." And he comes to the monastery intent upon searching for God. Now, just to give you a bit of a feel for how Luther is responding within this, for 1,000 years, if you were serious about following God, you would become a monk or a nun in a monastery or convent. So for 1,000 years, that's been the history of the church right up until this point. In fact, a little bit over 1,000 years. If you were serious about following God, then you became a monk or a nun, 9 times out of 10. Now, that was regarded as the most holy thing that you could do. It was denying yourself, it was saying goodbye to the world, it was sacrificing. They picked up all these bits of the Bible and they misunderstood them to arrive at that conclusion, but that was the way in which many within the church thought. And so Luther comes to a monastery believing that this is going to be the means by which, the place in which he's going to be able to come to know God. To give you an example of how he feels about everything, 1507, he's finally become a priest. He's about to celebrate his very first Mass. Now, you know, within a Roman Catholic context, that means that handling the body and the blood of Jesus, the bread and the wine, and they believe is the body and blood, it's a very serious thing. And so Luther is out the front, and he's got an older man, an older priest with him. It's a big occasion. His dad has finally come round to the fact that his son's going to become a priest and decided that there's a bit of social glory to be found in this after all. And so he's organised a big party. He's got 20-odd friends and family members have all travelled to the church in order to watch his son perform his first Mass. And he's even sent money ahead so as to organise a big party afterwards. So it's going to be it's a big occasion. All the family up the back, everybody beaming and excited. Big church full, everyone's waiting. He's out the front for this high point to which he's been working through his studies. And he gets to the point where he pronounces the words, "To thee, the eternal, living and true God," and Luther is overcome with terror. He is so frightened that then and there he wanted to leave it all behind and flee straight out of the church. Because as far as Luther is concerned, here he is handling the body and blood of God himself. And God is so terrifying. God is so holy. God is so remote. And Luther is so sinful. How could he have any contact with the holy and righteous God without being struck down? And so he's terrified. And he's ready to flee, and he turns to the older priest and he says, "Reverend Father, I'm afraid I must leave the altar." Now, the older priest was a man perhaps of some wisdom. And what he did was to shout at Luther, "Go faster, go faster. So get it over with. Get going. Don't think, don't imagine, don't speak, don't question, just do it." And so with all this social pressure, Luther goes ahead and he celebrates his Mass. And they have the big party afterwards. But it's that idea of the holiness of God, which is central to Luther's understanding of who God is and therefore of how Luther sits in relation to God. And the question for Luther is always, how can anyone be worthy to stand before or to appear before this God? Now, in 1508, he arrives in a little German city called Wittenberg in order to teach. He's obviously a good student. He's getting a doctorate, and he's going to be a lecturer. And he's there at the university in order to teach theology and the Bible. But he brings with him this uncertainty about his relationship with God. One writer has said that Luther knew himself to be unworthy to appear before this holy God, and his whole restless monastic life, and it was a life where he was constantly denying himself, completely messed up his digestive system through fasting over these years. He was never the same again. Through this deep sacrifice, this physical punishment of himself, he hoped to make himself worthy to stand before God. And so that is his dilemma. Now, these are just some pictures of Wittenberg. When you arrive at Wittenberg, Wittenberg was a part of the old East Germany. So it's most of the place is just this grey slab of concrete sort of apartment blocks. But they've maintained the historical centre. And so you can arrive in Wittenberg by train, and about 10 minutes in a taxi, you end up here. And that's just the beginning. And that's actually the castle church where Luther was to launch the Reformation. That's just another picture of the church, and that's where he used to preach quite regularly. It's this beautiful church. It, let me say, had a sandstone engraving of Jesus with just the head of Jesus, long hair and a beard, and coming out of his mouth, out of one side was a lily to show that Jesus was the man of peace, and out of the other side came a sword to show that Jesus was the man of judgment. And it used to be out the front of that church. And Luther used to say that he was so terrified that he couldn't bear to look at it when he went to church, because all he could see was the sword of judgment coming out of Christ's mouth. And so that's the context in which Luther is operating. And he says, the more I tried to remedy my uncertain, weak, and afflicted conscience with the traditions of men, the more every day I found it more and more uncertain, weaker, and more troubled. So the more he tried, the more he fasted, the more he prayed, the more he went out without sleep, the more he punished his body, the more he tried to do good works, the more he struggled with all of those things, the worse he got. Because he was so aware of how sinful he was. Now in 1510, he travels to Rome for business. It's a business trip for his monastic order. But he sees it as a great opportunity to do something good for his family. What he wants to do is, while he's in Rome, which of course is seen as one of the pilgrim centres, the religious capital of the church, while he's there, what he's hoping to be able to do is to celebrate masses and do various religious things in the hope that those good works will be counted in heaven to deliver his grandparents from purgatory. It's that whole works-based understanding of how we deal with God. He imagines his grandparents who are dead, and they are in purgatory, and they are working off their sin, unremitted sin, and if he can do some religious works now, they will be counted to reduce how many years they have to spend. That's his hope. He's so excited about going, he says, I found myself regretting that my parents weren't already dead, because I could have done it for them. He had a very unhappy time while he was in Rome. There were queues of priests waiting at all the big churches to celebrate Mass. So everyone's just like tourists queue nowadays to get in to see some of these churches. Priests were queuing in order to come to the altar in order to celebrate a Mass, with nobody watching particularly, but doing a religious work that would be seen as benefiting someone. He also climbed Pilate's steps. Now, if you go to Rome today and you visit one of the real central places, a church called the Church of St. John Lateran, across this busy intersection, there's this building that's fairly nondescript with not much in the way of signage. And it's not open very often. But when it is open, it reveals the steps of Pilate. Now, the tradition was that when the mother of the Emperor Constantine in the early 4th century went to the Holy Land, she found the steps on which Jesus stood when he stood before Pontius Pilate. And seeing these as being very holy, so the story went, she had them brought back to Rome and installed. And there they are there. They've been covered over for their protection, but they are Pilate's steps. And the idea in Luther's day was that a pilgrim would come and would climb the steps on their knees. As you can see, that's exactly what people are doing today. You go to that to visit and you'll find you can only go up the stairs on your knees. You can't walk up them. They've got other stairs either side if you want to walk up. But you can only go up on your knees as you pray. So that's what Luther did. Up those very steps, on his knees, every step he stopped and recited the Lord's Prayer and he kissed it, the floor, the step, not the prayer. He kissed the step for good measure. Every step, all the way up to the top, in the hope that by that act of religious devotion, somehow God would be happy with him. Can you see how far short of the gospel Luther is and the church is that he's a part of? When he got to the very top, he simply said, "Who knows whether it's so?" So who knows whether it was good enough? I mean, what if at step 36 I had a sinful thought? Maybe the whole thing's a waste of time because of that. Maybe when I was praying my 14th Lord's Prayer, I lost concentration, thought about something I shouldn't have thought about. Maybe all of that labour and God still looked down and said, "Well, you're still a lousy sinner, Luther, so I won't accept you." Who knows whether it's so? So for him, going to Rome was a really unhappy experience. He came home disillusioned. He said, "I too was so foolish as to carry onions to Rome and I brought back garlic." Now, I would have thought that was a good swap myself, but obviously for German peasants it's not. So as far as he was concerned, he took some good German onions down and all he got was some lousy garlic to take back with him. So it was a bad exchange. It was a disillusioning experience. And so he goes back to the monastery, he goes back to teaching, and he goes back to this life of desperately trying to make himself right with God by getting rid of anything that is tainted by sin. "I didn't think about women, money, or possessions. Instead, my heart trembled and fidgeted about whether God would bestow his grace on me." This is his doctorate in 1512. 1513, 14, his lectures on the book of Psalms, 2 years later on Romans. And gradually he comes to understand the doctrine of justification by faith alone in Christ alone. It was through studying the scriptures that he comes to understand that God is not only judge, but he is also saviour. That in the cross, not only the justice of God is seen, but the mercy of God as well. So that's a longish quote from him, but it's worth saying. The words righteousness of God. You know how Paul in Romans says the righteousness of God is revealed in the gospel. He says, those words, "the righteousness of God," struck my conscience like lightning. When I heard them, I was terrified. If God is righteous, I thought, then he must punish. See the jump? But when by God's grace I pondered over the words, "he who through faith is righteous shall live," and "the righteousness of God," I soon came to the conclusion that if we as righteous men ought to live from faith, and if the righteousness of God contributes to the salvation of all who believe, then salvation won't be our merit, but God's mercy. My spirit was thereby cheered, master of the understatement, for it's by the righteousness of God that we're justified and saved through Christ. These words, "the righteousness of God," which had before terrified me, now became more pleasing to me. Firstly, he said, I read them, and what I found was, look at the gospel. What do I find there? The righteousness of God, God's judgment against my sin. God punishes me for my sin. That's what the gospel tells me. But when by the grace of God I came to understand what the words really mean, he said, I realized that they're actually talking about Christ's righteousness being transferred to us. God in his righteousness clothing us in the righteousness of Jesus, so that nothing in my hand I bring, but simply to the cross of Jesus I cling. That was his understanding of the gospel. And for Luther, it was moving from darkness to light, and it changed everything. Absolutely everything for Luther. Because now, rather than always seeking to justify himself before God, he realizes that God has actually done it all for him in Jesus. I mean, it's the gospel. It's what you get every Sunday when Ray preaches to you. It's the gospel that you believed. And Luther comes to this understanding. Now, the implications of Luther's discovery. Just to explain a little bit about indulgences. In the Middle Ages, there was an idea about how to be right with God. That whole question of my good works being able to work off time in purgatory. What do you do? What about the people who had so much good works that they didn't actually need all of them? I don't know whether that question's ever come up over the last few minutes as I've been talking about it, but certainly occurred to medieval theologians. They said, what about those saints who were really, really holy, and they must have had a lot of good works that they didn't need? And so they came up with the idea of a big box in heaven full of the merits of the saints. And it was called the Treasury of Merits. And the idea was, it was like a bank balance. So excess merits from other people are deposited there, and the church was able to withdraw and hand them out to people. And what they were handing out were called indulgences, and they reduced the amount of time you spent in purgatory. Now, it began with you go on a crusade and die, then you'll get some indulgences. But a couple of hundred years later, the church has come up with the idea that you could actually sell them. And it was a fundraiser. And so indulgences are being sold all around Martin Luther to help pay for the building of St. Peter's in Rome. It was an odd arrangement. There was an Archbishop of Mainz who wanted a particularly important church position. And so he goes to the Pope of the day and he says, how much for this important position? And the Pope says, well, there are 12 apostles, so what about 12,000 gold ducats? That sounds like a nice round number. And the guy who's going to buy the church office says, well, there are 7 deadly sins. I'll give you 7,000 gold ducats. And so eventually they both agreed there were 10 commandments. So they settled on 10,000 gold ducats. So that was the price. So he borrows the money to pay it. Now, how's he going to repay it? Well, he goes to the Pope and he says, let me sell indulgences in my territories, all around where the Luther is. Let me sell indulgences. Half can go to you and half can go to me, and I'll repay my debt. So it was a win-win situation. So that's what happened. So he wants them sold aggressively. And there were indulgent sellers. They were almost evangelists. They would go around with a big fanfare, and they would go around preaching judgment and then offering you the sale of an indulgence, a little certificate that would reduce how much time you had to spend in purgatory. Now, can you imagine the sort of havoc that plays with church discipline? There was a story, and it was only a story, but there was a story that used to go around at the time about a wealthy nobleman who, when the indulgence seller came through his territories, said to the indulgence seller, listen, I'm sick of having to buy indulgences all the time. I just want to buy the lot. So I want to have a certificate that will cover everything from now, everything I've done right through until I die. Indulgence seller scratches his head and he says, that's going to cost a lot of money. And he says, I don't care, I'm wealthy, just easier. So he hands over a large amount of money and he gets an indulgence, covers all of his sins from now until he dies. The indulgence seller heads off. A couple of months later, he's heading back through the man's territories, his wagons laden down with the gold that he's been collecting from the sale of indulgences. The nobleman comes down with 2 or 3 armed soldiers and robs him blind. The indulgence seller, you can't do that. And he shows him his certificate of indulgence, says, yes, I can. Now, it was a story that was going around that illustrated people knew that there was a problem. People knew that it didn't do anything for church discipline, didn't do anything for holiness, but it did do a lot for the coffers of the church. And so you got these boxes like that one, which is one from Luther's day, and the coin would go in. And that was where they collected. It was like a great big safety chest. So Luther's new understanding of salvation comes up against this idea of indulgences. And of course, there's going to be heat, isn't there? The sparks are going to fly. And so he drafts 95 propositions, which sets out, they're very tentative. He's only just starting to explore all of this. But in 1517, that date that I said is worth remembering, he comes up with these 95 theses, 95 propositions, in which he questions the sale of indulgences. There's just one of them, number 28. See, what used to happen is that the salesman used to say that when the coin went in that box, the tinkle of the coin heralded a soul flying free from purgatory. So you hear the coin jingle to the bottom of the box, and you can imagine Grandpa flying straight out of purgatory. That was the jingle, if you like, that they were using.